Ma something to eat. I'm a friend to old Yule Gibbons, and I only eat homegrown spice. I got a John Keats autographed Grecian urn filled up with my brown rice. Yes, I do. Oh, folks, but lately I have been spotted with a Big Mac on my breath. Stumbling into a Colonel Sanders with a face as white as death. I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed with a handful of Pringles potato chips and a ding-dong by my head. In the daytime, I'm Miss Bonanza, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Fun little novelty number from Larry Gross from 1976. That is Junk Food Junkie. We'll send that one out to everyone listening in Charleston, West Virginia on the Status Quo WTSQ 88.1 FM. You see, Larry Gross hails from West Virginia and spent a number of years as the artistic director and host of Mountain Stage, the great national live music radio show that originates there in Charleston. But that song is just kind of a fun surprise that reached number 9 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. Larry Gross, Cruising the Decades. I'm Brad Savage. This show is heard worldwide on the greatest independent and community and music appreciating radio stations all around the world. Shortwave on WBCQ, The Planet, and Channel 292 out of Germany, and we're heard on The Eagle from Armed Forces Network, heard all around the world at all U.S. military bases, and for all the troops and all the U.S. embassies worldwide, including Eagle 810 in Tokyo, Japan. Take a look at the playlists and schedule and all the great radio stations that carry this show at cruisingthedecades.com. We're going to go on a little time warp now, an interview with Cy Kernan of The Fix, but this interview was actually released as a promotional LP for radio stations when their album Phantoms came out in 1984. So the time warp now to this historic interview.
This is Cy Kernan of The Fix, and this is our new album, Phantoms. Yeah, we thought that was quite an apt name after having spent a year virtually away from home all the time. And we all found that as a band that there's a sort of character deep down within you that tends to come out. The less responsibilities you have to your being based in one place, this other side of your character tends to sort of steer your moods. And it just went very easy. I mean, we had 16 songs. We knew we initially were going for 10, but we found out with a couple of short tracks we could get 12 on, which I think has given us a good balance for both sides. And also, there's a lot of pondering on albums, and we didn't want to ponder on too many ideas, just show that we had more ideas.
Now, what about the song, Sunshine in the Shade?
Well, it had to be short because it was a quick break in the clouds, sunshine in the shade. You know, it had to be just a quick glimmer of hope. It's just the idea of, again, you know, a good idea is only a thought away. If you're feeling bad, then you just remember when you're feeling good. We got all the information that we wanted to in the song, and the feel felt good. And coming from England, where the sun only ever comes out for like 2 minutes anyway, we gave it an extra 26 seconds, and that was a real hot summer. I'm very pleased with it. We had a good amount of time to write it. We were all very relaxed because we'd been on the road for a long time, so when you come off the road, you really relax into a comfortable lull, so we felt energetic after a couple of weeks, and we were able to, I think, work at our best for a lot of the period.
Cy Kernan of The Fix, the year 1984, off the album Phantoms. This is Sunshine in the Shade on Cruising the Decades.
Sunshine, warm in the small of my back. Studios of the Summit.fm in Akron, Ohio, USA. This is Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage.
Down.
voice of the late Dolores O'Riordan of the Cranberries. Now, that is a song called The Sun Does Rise, Job Wobbles, Invaders of the Heart, with Dolores O'Riordan on vocals, released in 1994. Job Wobble got his start as an original member of Public Image Limited with John Lydon, a.k.a. Johnny Rotten. He left the group after two or three albums and has done quite an extensive solo career and has a great cult following. I like that song because it's very clearly Dolores O'Riordan on vocals, but certainly it's not a Cranberries song, so it's kind of a rare track as we remember her contribution to great music. Once again, that was 1994 on Cruise in the Decades. I'm Brad Savage, Brad at thesummit.fm. We originate at the Summit FM, Akron, Ohio, USA. This show is now heard on over 60 great independent radio stations all around planet Earth. The mission? Bringing listeners together across vast distances through a shared love of music and the magic of the airwaves. CruisingTheDecades.com for all of our playlists. We're moving into the 21st century. We're going to go forward to 2005 with the band Spoon from Austin, Texas, off of their album Gimme Fiction. I Turn My Camera On from Spoon on Cruisin' the Decades.
I turn my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way I'm slipping away. I turn my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. Yeah. And you was a lie. You hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. Feelings on, I turn my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah. Like I'm gonna ignite. I saw them stars go off. I saw them stars go off at night. Thank you.
radio show that spotlights a love of all genres of music and sharing that eclectic music over the airwaves everywhere. This is Cruisin' the Decades with over 100 years of music on like-minded radio outlets everywhere. Stations that value music and community. There's something special about radio and signals over the air. One broadcast to an audience of many simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. This is Cruisin' the Decades, Global Edition.
Tonight I swear I'll come home and we'll make love last.
that came out of New England in the early 2010s. That is Passion Pit with Take a Walk. It's from their second album, Gossamer, released in 2012. CruisingTheDecades.com. And we're going to wrap up with a 2020s selection by a band that has really captured my ear and a really interesting, unusual, and anonymous band from the UK, Sleep Token. They're a hard rock meets metal band. I hesitate to call it heavy metal. I mean, it's almost more like if Tool meets Blue Oyster Cult or something like that. But they're anonymous. They wear masks. They don't really give interviews. They've got a massive following and recently hit number one on the U.S. albums chart with their most recent album, Even in Arcadia. Real interesting story. Definitely an interesting look and memorable sounds. Sleep Token. This is Damocles on Cruising the Decades.
Well, I've been waking up under blades, blue blossom days. If only Damocles would hit me back. No alabaster carvings or faces on a farthing would prevent my head from fading to black. And it feels like falling into the sea. From outer space in seconds to me. And I play discordant days on repeat. Until they look like harmony. When the river runs dry and the curtain is cold, how will I know if I can't see the bottom? Come up for air and choke on it.
really an interesting mix of sounds and styles. The Masked Men of Sleep Token. That was Damocles. The most recent number one album is called Even in Arcadia. 100 years of music. Find all of our playlists at cruisinthedecades.com.
Over 100 years of music history. In the course of just 1 hour, you've been listening to Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. This is the global edition produced for shortwave, FM, and AM stations worldwide on the leading independent community and music radio stations on the planet. This program originates at WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Ohio, USA. For correspondence or QSL, contact Brad at thesummit.fm. Thank you for supporting independent, eclectic radio broadcasting and signals over the air from all corners of planet Earth. One broadcast to an audience of many, simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. Join us next time for the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades.
So the bigger question is, how did the United States come to fight and sponsor and support these very bloody wars in both Vietnam and Palestine, where, you know, we have these massive losses of civilian lives and attacks on civilian installations, schools, you know, universities, hospitals, and so forth that happened in Vietnam as well. If you were to put together a list of the kinds of things the United States did, it would match with great, you know, synchronicity what's happening today with Israel.
That's Robert Bezanko, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Robert Bezanko on Vietnam then, Palestine now. Separated by decades, the U.S. war in Vietnam and the Israeli war in Gaza are very different. Vietnam had support from China and the Soviet Union. The Palestinians have no allies. The sheer scale of the U.S. assault on not only Vietnam, but Cambodia and Laos as well, immeasurably dwarfs the death toll Israel is exacting in Gaza. In both wars, there was massive use of air power. It didn't work in Vietnam, and it's not working in Gaza. On the home front, it took years for people to protest the U.S. war. In the case of Gaza, it was almost immediate, and it continues. Media coverage was also different. Vietnam was famously called the Living Room War. Israel has banned journalists from reporting in Gaza, and most of our stalwarts of the Fourth Estate have remained silent. To talk about Vietnam then and Palestine now is Robert Bezanko. He's an award-winning scholar and a professor emeritus in history at the University of Houston. He's co-host of the Green and Red podcast, and his articles have appeared in the Houston Chronicle, Counterpoint, and The Guardian. He's the author of Masters of War and Vietnam and the Transformation of American Life. He spoke at the Jerusalem Fund's Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And now, Robert Bezanko.
There are great lessons to be learned by studying other areas and to see how the United States responds. And I want to begin to kind of describe this with a personal vignette. I was always interested in history and politics, and this was probably somewhere in the mid-70s. A magazine had a Yasser Arafat on the cover, which I found intriguing. And I read the article, which kind of took the typical narrative about, you know, the Palestinians are terrorists and this and that. But, it, you know, there was a spark in me saying, I want to learn more. And in that way, from a very early stage in my life, I discovered what was happening there. And so I learned a great deal about Palestine from studying Vietnam. And I still think that's a valuable lesson there, that we can learn about a lot of different historical episodes, but also from understanding these larger contexts. Talking about Vietnam today is very different than it was some time ago. like all episodes, history changes, the history of them changes, but not because what happened changed, but because the way we look at it changes. There's a very famous quote from Orwell along the lines of whoever controls the past controls the present and therefore controls the future. So it's what people say about a particular event that becomes important. Nietzsche said what we call things is more important than what they are. In 2017, there was a huge national kind of campaign to promote a new PBS special by the very famous documentarian Ken Burns about Vietnam, and it got all kinds of attention and acclaim. And in it, Burns takes what had become a fairly common idea that the Vietnam War was more or less a noble cause, that the U.S. went in there with the best of intentions and they made a mistake. And this reminds me today of a lot of the media reports we get where they talk about Israel being the most moral army in the world or the only democracy in the region. So what you call things becomes more important than what they are. The United States was well aware of what was going on in Vietnam. It didn't go in with blinders any more than it's supporting with billions of dollars in weapons what's happening today, an actual genocide. And so there are significant parallels. And in fact, the Israeli attack on Iran, it kind of reminds you of the United States expanding the war when it was fighting in Vietnam already into the adjacent states of Cambodia and Laos. And that regional element is really important, I think, in both of these cases. The Vietnam War was catastrophic. We don't think about it as much as we once did. I think it was one of the more important events in the 20th century after World War II. It was significant meaning still to this day. To a large degree, the response to the Vietnam War, the lessons learned of the Vietnam War, shaped much of what's occurred since then. For the U.S., the losses were great, 58,000 dead, huge amounts of money spent. There are some estimates that it was in, adjusted for today's dollar, in the vicinity of like $1.5 or $2 trillion that the United States spent in Vietnam. And that's the thing to keep in mind too. We tend to focus on the United States in these episodes, but the Vietnamese probably had 2 to 3 million killed, the vast majority of whom were civilians, were non-combatants, and were actually living north of the 17th parallel where Vietnam had been cut in half. And so we see that today where, you know, we have these massive losses of civilian lives and attacks on civilian installations, schools, you know, universities, hospitals, and so forth that happened in Vietnam as well. So just kind of a little bit of background. In the period after World War II, both Southeast Asia, where Vietnam is located, and the Middle East became more important to the United States. One little bit of theory that I do throw out there, because I think it's kind of an important, intriguing idea, and this comes from a friend of mine who's a scholar in Australia named Clinton Fernandez, who writes a lot about sub-imperial powers. And he writes about Australia, but he also has written, along with Israel, sub-imperial powers share certain features that characterize them. They're capable. They have technologically advanced militaries and intelligence services that operate in the entire region and far afield to uphold a U.S.-led order. Trade investment agreements are organized with a similar goal in mind. Public opinion in these countries tends to be pro-U.S., obviously. They have stable governments, more or less, strong economic performance, and educated citizens. And I think when we look at Israel today in particular, it does fit that framework of a sub-imperial power operating to defend American interests. I know there's a big debate, we're not going to get into it now, over who actually controls whom, right? Does Israel control the U.S. or vice versa? I tend to still accept a kind of an older argument put forth by a lot of people that America's interest in Israel is based on having an ally in the region, or as Noam Chomsky called it, a cop on the beat. There's no doubt that there are influences with groups like AIPAC. We see that every election year. But Israel serves a purpose to defend American interest, and that grows increasingly after World War II. So the bigger question is, how did the United States come to fight and sponsor and support these very bloody wars in both Vietnam and today in Palestine? Both of these exist because of larger interests. They're not really about, per se, Vietnam or Palestine, although those are the areas that take the biggest hits in these catastrophes and these massive wars with massive uses of technology and just, you know, kind of the most brutal modern wars that we've seen. So there are larger interests. So, for instance, in Vietnam, in Asia, America's role, especially after October 1st, 1949, when the Chinese Revolution succeeded, changed. And the United States, after China went communist, found it absolutely critical, essential to preserve Japan, country it had just defeated, as an American ally in order to develop capitalist economies in Asia. So America's goal initially was to have both Japan and China in America's orbit. And as the Chinese piece of that fell apart, Japan became more important. And because of that, places like Vietnam become important. If you want Japan to be the kind of leader, the core of capitalism in Asia, then the surrounding areas have to be part of that economic orbit as well. So that becomes very important. And then I would argue that the Middle East is similar to that. During and after World War II, the Middle East became far more important, especially in World War II, for things like oil, shipping lanes in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and so forth. And so Israel and then Palestine would fit into that larger framework as well. Internally, you know, when we say why Vietnam or why Gaza today, one of the crucial issues is going to be land. And that's similar in both places. Vietnam is a pre-modern society when this begins, the Vietnamese Revolution. The groundwork is laid really in the World War I era. So the struggle is about land. In parts of Vietnam, less than 2% of Vietnamese owned land. Vietnam was a French colony. And so the biggest landholders tended to be somehow collaborating or part of the administrative apparatus of the French, which means that the vast majority of Vietnamese, I think the population of Vietnam, I believe, is about 25 million in the World War II era. And the vast majority of those people had no land at all. And so when the revolution began, one of the key slogans was land to the tiller. And obviously, when it comes to the Middle East, we've all seen those maps of land ownership, right? In the early 1900s, and then the 1947 map, the UN partition map, the 1967 map, and so on. So the ownership of the actual land there and the type of land you own, land that's actually arable, land that has irrigation available, is really crucial in both places. In both countries, you have more so in Palestine an indigenous population. So the West begins to essentially deny their own history. In Vietnam, the media put out the line that North Vietnam had invaded South Vietnam, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And that's not really that dissimilar to saying that Palestine was a land without people, for a people without land. The Vietnamese Revolution, the roots of it can be seen in the World War I era, because Vietnam was a French colony. You had significant level numbers of expats living in Paris, especially younger Vietnamese who were nationalists. They were educated. They were trained in these kind of nationalist ideas. They were closely connected to this idea of kind of an Asian response to white supremacy. These expats in France included people who had become very well known in the 50s and 60s leading the war. Obviously, the best known was a young man named Nguyen Un Quoc, who became Ho Chi Minh, Va Nguyen Giap, Trong Chinh, Lê Duẩn, Lê Đức Tô, and many, many others. They met. They actually formed an Indo-Chinese Communist Party. So the war in Vietnam is kind of a hybrid. During the war, the U.S. would always argue that it had to stop communism in Vietnam. A lot of the critics of America would say it's not a communist country, it's nationalist. Well, it's both, right? The people who ran the revolution were part of the Indochinese Communist Party, but it was not confined to that. Anybody could really be part of it. If you were anti-French, you could be part of it. So it's actually a huge front. And though the leaders and much of the ideological program would be labeled communist or leftist or something, the movement itself was not. I would probably suggest 80% of the people initially opposed to it were not communists. They're Buddhist intellectuals, just people who didn't like France. So during the 1930s, then, these folks who had met in Paris and elsewhere formed a group, an organization inside Vietnam called the Viet Minh. And the Viet Minh began to lead the resistance to the French in the 1930s. It really kind of coincides with the Palestine Revolution of the late 1930s, too. So this is occurring in both places. And there is this kind of beginning of this worldwide anti-colonial movement that you see. And I would argue that the Vietnamese and the Palestinians are both part of that. This took on more urgency as Japan during World War II, which was trying to gain control over all of Asia, went into Vietnam and kicked out the French. And so Japan took over Vietnam. And the Viet Minh, Ho Chi Minh and his comrades were very vital in that resistance. In fact, they worked closely with the Americans, with the Organization of Strategics, the OSS. The precursor to the CIA. The United States is already involved in that region, but it's not terribly important to them. And they actually have a pretty good impression of Ho Chi Minh as well, which was interesting. So the Viet Minh were vital in that resistance. And so when Japan finally lost after the atomic bombs were dropped in early September of 1945, Ho Chi Minh, who was the leader of the Viet Minh, went out into the main square in Hanoi and announced the creation of, or announced basically a Vietnamese declaration of independence, the creation of a Vietnamese state. And ironically, within Ho's speech, he quoted the Declaration of Independence. He began by saying, "We hold these truths to be evident that all men and women are created equal." He invoked Thomas Paine and the rights of man. He reached out to the United States. The Vietnamese sent letters to Harry Truman and others in Washington saying, "Hey, we want some kind of a relationship." The United States rejected that because they said, "Well, the Vietnamese are just China's puppets. They're just another part of the Chinese communist movement," which couldn't have been further from the truth. Vietnam and China don't like each other at all and really still don't. So after that, the French, even though Vietnam, the French had been kicked out by the Japanese, France seemed to be, you know, kind of fading, colonialism seemed to be fading. There was a lot of anti-colonial rhetoric coming out of places like Washington, D.C., here at Franklin Roosevelt especially. But that anti-colonial rhetoric wasn't based on the idea that people should be sovereign or they should be free. Anti-colonial rhetoric is based on the idea that markets should be free. Colonies, remember, are closed. You can only trade within the home country or whatever. That's why the United States opposed colonialism and it opposed Britain and it opposed France and all these other countries, right? In the third world, the message came across differently. So when they heard Westerners talking about anti-colonialism, they believed that that meant independence for themselves. This reminds me in 1917, Woodrow Wilson said that World War I was a war to make the world safe for democracy. Inside the U.S., African-American activists heard that and thought, oh, well, if he's going to make the world safe for democracy, that includes us. Woodrow Wilson never meant that. And the U.S. didn't really mean that either when it talked about anti-colonialism. So the French went back in and reestablished control over Vietnam. Again, it's not a direct parallel to Israel and Palestine, but clearly you have the same dynamics working there. The United States had, and again, larger interests, and I think that's one of the important parallels between these. America's interests were regional. The United States actually tried to discourage the French from going in and reestablishing control of Vietnam because it wanted France to be focused totally on Europe and the Cold War in Europe and the Soviet Union. But when France said no, the U.S. went along because it didn't want to alienate them, and it also didn't want to give support to the French left. The idea of politics and elections is really crucial in both places. The United States was always meddling in elections in both places, often making sure that its guy won, or in the case of, let's say, Gaza, trying to make sure that the wrong people didn't win, and when they did, having to kind of go in and try to adapt after that. They also wanted, as I mentioned a minute ago, Asian allies for Japan. They wanted the Japanese to feel like they had other nations nearby with whom they could trade, where they could get resources, where they could have security arrangements, right? There was also an economic reason. At the end of World War II, the world was just destroyed, and the United States wasn't. The war wasn't fought in the U.S., and so the United States was at its productive peak, but it didn't have anywhere to sell this stuff. And one of the problems was that there are potential markets all over, countries badly in need of reconstruction materials, but they don't have money. So another reason to go into places like Vietnam was because of the so-called dollar gap. The United States went into these areas to give them money so that they could then in turn back and purchase goods from the United States, right? These are often referred to as offset arrangements, and one need only look at the amount of weapons the United States has, you know, sold to Israel over the years to get a real sense of that. In 2022, before Russia invaded Ukraine, and then again in right after October 2023, many of the military industrial corporations, you know, Raytheon and so forth, were publicly tweeting about how good this was going to be for their stock prices and how good it was going to be for business. So they were pretty candid about that. And you clearly see that as well with regard to Vietnam, to kind of try to give money to these Asian countries so that they can in turn spend it back and alleviate this dollar gap. So all these things are going on. An area that had not been terribly important to the U.S. suddenly is becoming more so. Much of this early phase, as I mentioned, does seem to parallel the Palestinian revolution of the 1930s. These are both pre-industrial societies. They involve workers and peasants in both particular cases. These are groups, the Viet Minh and the Palestinians, who do not have important allies all over the globe. They're localized rebellions without a great deal of outside support. And obviously, we know that with regard to Palestine, the Europeans since World War I era had been trying to, you know, dispossess them, right? The Balfour Declarations in 1917. And then you have European support of settlement into the region, largely because the Europeans were so really anti-Semitic, right? They wanted them out. So both Vietnam and Palestine in this era, the World War II, early Cold War years, are part of this world historical anti-colonial movement. The United States has always been hostile to liberation movements. And you could find, I'm talking about Vietnam today because I know it well. I could have talked about Cuba. I could have talked about Indonesia. I could have talked about Venezuela. Could have talked about Iran. Could have talked about, Suez. I mean, there's a million different things that fit into this. But in that era, obviously, Vietnam was the biggest, right? And today, obviously, it's the Middle East. In 1946, then, after France came back in, the so-called First Indochina War began. And this is just a couple of years before the recognition of Israel. So again, there are parallels. And then by the early 1950s, the United States had begun sending huge amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, which in the late 40s and early 50s is a significant investment, especially in an area that had never really been that important. The United States, like I said, never really had much interest. So in 1950, the U.S. sent something like $400 million to support the French against the Vietnamese. So it's deeply involved, not really because it cares about Vietnam, but because the region is important and it fears that if Vietnam goes communist, there was also a rebellion in Malaya. The Korean War was underway. So the U.S. saw Vietnam as a much bigger piece of this kind of regional idea, this regional program for hegemony. So the main focus then is on these material ideas, commerce, trade, and so forth, in particular what they call the open door, the idea of free trade. The Middle East is similar, but it's based not necessarily on commerce so much as on resources. During World War II, oil and shipping lanes in the region, in the Middle East, became far more important. And the United States actually had a decent relationship with the Arab states because of that. There were significant elements of the United States military, especially establishment, but the entire foreign policy establishment, who were leery of being seen as being too closely connected to this new state or this new group of people who were coming in, even as they were, you know, the Irgun and Stern gang were committing what would certainly be called terrorist atrocities and so forth. So the United States wasn't advocating that, but the United States wanted to maintain stability in that region because it wanted access to oil and to those shipping lanes, because if you're going to fight a Cold War against the Soviet Union, that region is incredibly vital. So in both places now, you see the United States taking a bigger role. In 1954 in Vietnam, the Vietnamese Revolution succeeded. It won. It defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu. And once again, Ho Chi Minh, as he had in 1945, thought he would be in charge of this unified country, but it was not to be so. The United States, at a conference in Geneva, partitioned Vietnam in half. They created artificial borders, right? Again, we know what that means. And they said that there would be elections in 1956 to unify Vietnam. Well, they were never going to have those elections in 1956. It was very clear. The United States invented a country in Vietnam. Vietnam's one country. It has three regions, but it's one country, right? There's no north and south. In 1954, the United States cuts Vietnam in half at the 17th parallel. And below the 17th parallel, it creates this country, which it will call the RVN, the Republic of Vietnam. Republic of Vietnam did not have any kind of indigenous movement toward creating its own country. It was invented. And then the United States also invented regional arrangements like CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. And this occurs not coincidentally at the same time the United States created the Baghdad Pact for the Middle East. I don't see a lot of linkage. The United States isn't saying, you know, here's Vietnam, here's Palestine. It's part of something much bigger than that. And they both fit in with that framework, especially with these regional arrangements. So they're very serious. And the United States begins increasing aid to both places. By 1954 and 55, the United States was sending in $300 to $400 million. This is after the French left and after they invented this country, the RVN, below the 17th parallel, and after they had said there will be elections in 1956. Well, there's clearly never any intention to have elections because they're going all in. In addition to that, once again, the land issue comes in, which again is very clearly parallel in Palestine. In the brief period that Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh controlled all of Vietnam, they instituted land reform programs. In 1954 and 1955, with American support, all of those were reneged upon. And so land, which had been given to peasants and others, was returned to a lot of these older landholders, many of whom were connected to the French and, you know, who were very wealthy and very American oriented. It's striking that even in the modern world, and we're talking in the 1950s when commerce and global wars are the issue, but land is still crucial. In many ways, it's almost, you know, kind of a definitional. If a country attempts some kind of land reform, the U.S. is against it. Land reform by itself to the U.S. is radical or communist or whatever. At the same time this is happening, though, the Middle East became more important as well. Interest there was blossoming as part of these larger regional goals. But the growing influence of Zionism, the Palestine Revolution in the 1930s, and the Holocaust obviously changed all that. This movement now to resettle Jews from Europe or anywhere into the region grew increasingly popular. In 1947, the UN voted on Resolution 181, which led Israel to become a recognized state. And I would argue it was invented in the same way that the Republic of Vietnam was. The United States created these political entities in order to have this kind of air of legitimacy, because they wanted their own role in these regions, didn't want to do it directly, right? Again, kind of like the idea of the gendarme or the cop on the beat or whatever. So these liberation movements were already present then by the 1950s and in both places. And this is important. Both were immediately met with resistance internally. In Vietnam, the growth of the Viet Minh and the DRVN, the North Vietnamese above the 17th parallel, were posed as threats to the United States. In the Middle East, there was a significant blowback to Israel becoming a recognized state. The United States was seen as another appendage to the British or the French or other Western imperialist countries. The South Vietnamese were actually admitted to the United Nations in 1955. So these two countries, Israel and the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, now have international legitimacy, international credibility. But in both cases, as I mentioned, there were significant resistance immediately. There was significant resistance to it immediately. The United States wasn't the target per se. The United States wasn't doing imperialism the way the Europeans did. It wasn't sending a bunch of troops into occupied. It was using proxies and taking other measures, right? And the U.S. knew that it wasn't popular. Everybody in American official circles, when they analyzed Vietnam, said, they don't want us there. They like Ho Chi Minh. They like the Viet Minh. Everybody from Dwight Eisenhower, the president, on down said, if there's an election in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh won 80 to 90% of the vote. So they had to avoid that. You pretend there's a democracy, you call it a democracy. This is an epic battle between democracy and communism. And in fact, in the 50s, that language was often used with the Middle East too, especially after Nasser, right? Even though obviously Nasser you know, he had connections to the Soviet Union getting aid and so forth. But, you know, inside Egypt, he was, you know, attacking the Egyptian Communist Party, but it didn't matter, right? It's just like today, right?
You're listening to Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
It's interesting along these lines. I found this document some time ago, which I thought was really quite amazing. It was dated May 1st, 1950. It's very early on, right? And it was sent from the Department of State. Dean Acheson was Secretary of State at the time, and it was sent to diplomatic and consular officials. And the title of it was Anti-Americanism is Resurging in the Arab World. And it went on at some length, describing in detail many of the anti-American actions it had seen in Syria and Lebanon. The document could have been written yesterday, changed the date and the names. It was exactly the same. And one part of it, though, which I really kind of, you know, focused in on, it gave a list of the reasons why the Middle East was becoming anti-American. And one of them was, and this is a Department of State quote, one of the reasons was a sincere objection to America's part in Palestine developments. So by 1950, the United States is well aware of what its involvement in the region is doing. And so the blueprint is already in place for this expanded role. And then you see, you know, in rapid fire, you see events like Suez in 1956. In 1953, you saw the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then you have the overthrow of revolution led by Karim Qasim. 1958, there's an intervention in Lebanon to try to actually, at that point, prop up Kamil Kamoun, and so on. So the United States is increasingly involved. And within those areas, you start to see the development of indigenous resistance. In 1960, inside southern Vietnam, the anti-American, let's call them that for a moment, forces established the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam. And then in 1964, the PLO was established. Something interesting, too, is the idea of, for want of a better term, geographical legitimacy. The United States will always say that, and Ken Burns and liberals say this today still, that North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam. The resistance really was in the South. The North clearly had, was run by the Communist Party of Vietnam. Most of the Southern resistance were people who were Southerners. You know, the U.S. would say they were outsiders and they were, you know, trained in the North to go into the South and so forth. The vast majority, almost the entire resistance in Southern Vietnam was Southern. These are people who had fought with the Viet Minh, they'd fought against the French, and they remained there. For the most part, the resistance in Southern Vietnam was indigenous. Right. And we hear this all the time, this trope of outsiders coming in and creating problems with regard to the PLO in Palestine. We know that it's an indigenous movement based on these really longstanding developments. But the same thing happens in Vietnam, too. You would continue to hear this, you know, they invaded us kind of stuff. But the reality is, first, there really weren't two Vietnams. One was just artificially invented. And the reality was that the Vietnamese fighting in the South, trying to get rid of the government, were actually Southerners themselves. And, you know, when I started to understand politics later than the 60s, but not much, two of the people who were often lauded and linked together were Ho Chi Minh and Yasser Arafat, you know, as well as Castro and Che and Nelson Mandela and others. But Ho and Arafat were always lauded on the left as part of the same struggle. And, you know, you don't have to be a communist to understand the importance of those third world revolutions. They gave each other support, but it was also important to have countries like the Soviet Union and China with regard to these smaller places because they had what they saw as some protection. They had a little bit of cover, which I think is one of the biggest differences today because Palestine's isolated in ways that Vietnam never was. Vietnam fought on its own. It had an amazing military, but it also got significant levels of support and aid from countries like the Soviet Union and China, whereas obviously today in Gaza, there's nothing like that, and the other Arab states are not involved in way.
Into an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is God.
Remember, I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always, because I'm omnipresent. I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Grazie tante per il poco che mi dai, ma ancora più grazie per il meno che mi aspetta. Che tanto, ma tanto per il quanto che ti do. Grazie tante per il poco che mi dai, ma ancora più grazie.